KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. After a storied career in stages all over the world and a feature film debut only a few years ago with True Story, he's back with his new film, Judy. Of course, I'm talking to the director, Rupert Gould. Rupert, first of all, thanks so much for being here.
Lovely to be here. Thanks, Elvis.
And what's so fascinating about this, all the work for you, as I've seen, basically deals with a kind of unreliable narrator, doesn't it?
Yeah, I suppose that was a big preoccupation of mine. You know, and, you know, of course, Judy Garland herself has many people narrating her own life. And you know, in some ways, my particular film, I think, treats her, the end of her life a little bit like a kind of passion play. And just as with, this is rather grand, but just as with the Christ story, I suppose you have a number of testimonies about what really went down. That sort of feels true of Garland's life as well, is that there are all these characters in her life, yeah, relatives, family members, loyal fans, strangers even, one of whom was involved in making the film with us, who sort of bear witness to this extraordinary life. And that's the nature of an icon, a legend, and a sort of, you know, in some ways I think Garland is like a sort of secular saint. You know, she sort of defines ideas of love and transcendence outside a sort of faith-based context. And I think that's why her, you know, although there may be many narrators to her life, I think the consensus is that there's a kind of importance in that life, and it's a great American life as well.
I guess so. I was bringing up this idea of unreliable narrator, because I was thinking about True Story, and suddenly the Shakespeare plays you've done, where we're not quite sure where the truth is.
Yeah.
And what would really these things seem to be about is finding or divining an emotional truth, don't they?
Yes. I mean, I think one of the themes that I've persistently returned to as well is loneliness, I suppose, and unreliability or uncertainty about the story we are telling or being told about us precipitates a loneliness or a sense of isolation. And although I think the stories of Macbeth and Judy Garland are very different, I suppose that there is a similar preoccupation, certainly in the film we made, about somebody who has been sort of hemorrhaged from any sense of norm, any sense of societal or familial kind of norm, and is living a life at an extreme.
Well, we can even say the opening of the film is this creation of this idyllic youth that you pull back. In fact, I was thinking it's almost like seeing Pirandello done in Brechtian terms.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, because there is that. I felt like I was watching six characters in a bit of a way.
Yeah, I mean, it was a play I did a while ago as well.
Oh, did you do that too?
Yeah, I did in the West End. Yeah, I suppose there is that Pirandellian quality. I was interested in the idea that Garland's, we could present the young Garland detached from her parents, and this is an artifice, obviously, who was literally sort of incubated on the lot, as it were, and that her early life was sort of totally made in the petri dish of the studio system. And so all the scenes where we see the young Garland are literally within the studio walls and often playing with the idea of what is real or what is not real. And so scenes you think you are seeing with a kind of verite turn out to be a sort of fantasy or an artifice.
And you take a very long time to do that in the opening, don't you? I mean, because this idea of creating dislocation at the very outset is something you're attracted to too, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. And I think, I suppose, The Wizard of Oz, which is where we sort of open the movie in reference to it, is such a sort of certainty in our lives. Even though it's a crazy, fantastic story, it's a certainty in that we all, it's one of the first stories we're ever told or ever see as children, and I think it's meant to be the most watched movie in history. And so I wanted to kind of revisit this sort of source point for us all and sort of tease at what actually might really have been going on. And some of the stories of the making of that film are quite complicated. So, yeah, but I was also influenced a bit by films like The Truman Show or AI, the Spielberg film, which I think is a really underrated, wonderful movie.
And it has its Kubrickian touches because Kubrick had developed it.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Where you get these AI, I guess, because you get a child who thinks they're normal and isn't, and is an android, and that felt very Garland-like. Truman Show, someone who thinks they're living in a real world, but turns out that when they push against what's real, they are... they realize it's artifice and then try and find a reality. And I suppose that's the sort of central journey for Garland in our film, is trying to return to a reality. And you know, I also felt that these concerts she gave and this last period of her life in London for me was like a sort of weird mirror of The Wizard of Oz, in that there she was desperately trying to get back home in later life to her children in a strange land, encountering strange people, finding warmth and affection in surprising places, ultimately in a journey that sort of may or may not be hollow, we don't quite know. And I was sort of interested how those two sort of return stories, Wizard of Oz and then this moment late in her life, kind of reflect each other.
I guess I find it interesting too, because for me the most telling moments and the most frightening moments are the moments where we see exercises of will mm-hmm. on the young Judy's behalf, which in where we live now would be welcomed, but mm-hmm. given that she was basically branded cattle mm-hmm. and treated like a circus animal mm-hmm. were the things that were the most terrifying for her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think why she celebrated and remembered is that she was willful. It gave her that incredible sense of humor and her wit.
And then she's provisionally, a lot of these characters you're attracted to could be seen as victims.
Yeah.
Even thinking about some of the true story some of the Shakespeare stuff you've done. But you're more interested in sort of pulling back the way we looked at victims, aren't you?
Yeah, I know. You could call them victims. They're also transgressors. I think they're interested in breaking rules. And I suppose that what we call in England the Marlowian overreacher, the figure who kind of, the Icarus-like figure who kind of trying to shoot for the sun and burns themselves is definitely a character that I've kind of come back to a lot in on stage and on screen in some ways. Garland, I don't think is actually, she's transgressive, but maybe trying to find a purpose rather than with a purpose in some ways. And that's part of her tragedy.
Well, I think transgressive without self-awareness, I mean, which becomes an interesting kind of thing because it's just, she's basically creating a world for herself. We're trying to create a world inside this world that's been created for her. So again, that's why I was talking about Pirandello, because of these kinds of constant sort of psychic and literal walls being broken down and boundaries being erected around her that she has to try to figure out where she can push and where she can't.
Yeah, and I think I find the – you just need to go to YouTube and you'll see all the TV interviews she gave, particularly later on in her life. And, you know, you can see she's, you know, whether that's immediate in terms of she's had a couple of drinks or something before them, or years of sustained abuse from the studio system, but and her own lifestyle choices, there's something constantly performative about her. And what's interesting is you're trying to look through all those different layers of mask, and you know there's something very real and emotional and essential about her, otherwise she wouldn't connect in the way she does. And yet she's having to play so many different roles for so many different people as a sort of camp icon, the diva, the mother, the you know, how she deals with aging. An actress in London said to me, "Oh, well, one of the reasons she's so revered is she was the first of us who grew up on screen. You know, she was the one who she never had the reality. She never had a normal life." And I find that fascinating.
It's a treatment going to the director of Judy, Rupert Gould, and I guess one of the things I was thinking about with this too is just that there's this. Some of these projects you've done, and I would include Judy with that, are pieces that people feel some sort of sense of, they feel proprietary about them. Mm-hmm. People think that they own and know Judy Garland. They think that they know and they own so many of the Shakespeare works. Mm. And part of what interests you is the idea of getting people to sort of discard those notions that, of the, and you even address that in the film with some of her fans. And you're getting people to get past that to see what the person is inside of that.
Yeah, I think that's astute. I mean, whether that's just provocative on my part or comes with purpose, but I suppose
is there purpose in it? Because there seems to be deliberation in so many of your choices. I can't help but think that there's something purposeful about it.
Yeah, I suppose, you know, particularly with the sophistication of audiences now in all art forms, it's so easy to get ahead. You know, and you sort of see where the thriller is going or what the jump scares in the horror movie are going to be or how the novel is going to twist and turn. And so what I find with subjects that are kind of known or recognized, either fictional, as in classical roles, or you know, figures that may be known to the public like Garland, is you want to immediately move away or try and challenge what they're going to expect. And I think, so for example, for me, I wanted to make Judy like a really real mother, like a real woman, right? Not this sort of crazy, sort of batshit kind of diva and sort of camp performance artist, but someone human and vulnerable. And I also wanted to make Garland at the end of her life very visible and true. And I think that's, I was interested in like how, with a lot of famous people, we think we know them from maybe quite a narrow window of their lives. And of course, their lives existed way before that and way after that in most cases. And to try and make people look more hard at that. Yeah.
Because I was thinking too, as you were talking about, because I watched some of the YouTube clips before I saw the movie. Mm. And what I was struck by, and Renée Zellweger really does that here, is her quick-wittedness. Mm. I mean, we almost get the sense that she's almost constantly anesthetized or not in control. But in fact, that almost gets that performative instinct of knowing the right thing to say or the wrong thing to say. Mm. And it's almost like it was a reflexive thing, that wit of hers, wasn't it?
Oh, my God, yeah. She was so funny, so funny. And I mean, that's again, you can see a lot of that in the footage online. She was... you know, a born wisecracker. I mean, and a great comedian, particularly from those earlier movies, the Andy Hardy movies. She's just like, her timing is exceptional. But I think it was probably a defense mechanism. You know, it's a sort of Dorothy Parker-like kind of ability to turn adversity into a joke, and that's self-deprecating and ironic and biting at times. But normally you can see there's some pain behind the eyes with each wisecrack. And so it was a very funny, Tom Edge, the screenwriter, had done a wonderful, wonderful script that way. And, you know, Renée is a great, great comedian. So those scenes were a joy to shoot. And in some ways, the dialogue of the movie is quite old-fashioned in that sense. It's sort of almost like a 60s movie with, like, lots of gags in it. I think what Renée does that's so brilliant is that you do see behind that. I think you sense what's going on behind that.
But I guess I said reflexive because in some ways, and this is the sense we get from between performance and where you stage it too, it's almost as if it is reflexive, as if something is touched and she reacts to it rather than there being any calculation in it. And that's really the tragedy, that there was no sort of calculation in her life, just kind of buffered it from one force to another.
Yeah, I think she was utterly unedited. She just had these Pavlovian responses and, you know, it's what made her performances so immediate. And, you know, I think there's something awful about the voyeurism of her audiences, which we all have, which is you don't know whether you're going to get a night that's a car crash or a night that's going to be transcendent. And I don't think Garland probably knew literally until she opened her mouth sometimes.
And that's in the staging too. I mean, there's this weird almost suspense film tension every time she steps onto the stage. I mean, right from the from the rafters, walking onto the stage, as a matter of fact. And that must have been part of your fascination with this, wasn't it?
Yeah, I feel like I've been around and up close to performers, and particularly singing. I think singing is particularly, it affects, it's a physical act, it's a spiritual act, a emotional act, and rooted in all, it's in the brain as well as the body. And I've seen opera singers and musical theatre singers, what happens when they're fearful that their voice may not be there for them is really torturing, like an athlete losing their, you know, when you see a tennis player who suddenly loses their serve or something, and you go, oh, it's appalling, and yet they can't escape that. So there was that going on. But also I think the film is at some level about what happens to an artist as they realize their gift is fading and how they remake it. You know, you think about, I don't know, Johnny Cash or Joni Mitchell.
Or a tennis player who can't serve but can still do a backhand. Yeah. And you learn to fall back on other things that you have.
And I think you see it with Federer at the moment. You sort of think, like, the grace is still there, but increasingly you're aware that, you know, the robustness physically isn't quite
there. He's not
there.
The net so much anymore.
Yeah, and so you treasure even more those points even, let alone games, where you see the grace that is going to be gone from us probably not too many years. And I was interested in that as a quality, like the sort of autumnal quality of artistry and performance. And, it is a... Judy, I think, was terrified that they would expect Carnegie Hall at this point in her life, and she barely had more than an octave left in her voice. But she had that incredible phrasing, that intuitive pitch, and she was a storyteller in song. And that's, you know, in a way, relying on that became a different sort of art form from the one that she had before when she was just a sort of athlete. That's what the film's interested in.
We're going to take a little break and talk a little bit less about tennis and more about Judy with its director, Rupert Gould. It's The Treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
Thank you. KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes. Join Jacqueline Coley as she hosts a brand new podcast, Scene on Screen. Meet the innovative people at NBC Universal as they share their journeys, inspirations, and the movies that define them. Each episode is an intimate and fun conversation about the impact of film. Scene on Screen is available now, wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back. I guess it's a match point with my guest, Rupert Gould, the director of Judas, the Treatment. But one of the things I just find so interesting, too, is the idea of these, for you, finding these characters who are kind of lost in a narrative that's bigger than them. And at some point, there's something like possession. I mean, you're talking about being backstage with singers, and at some point, they're waiting to be taken away by this thing that they can take the audiences with them. There's something that's more transportative about what they do than actors, I think, and that fear that they, even technique, will only get you so far. You want to be able to have this big thing. And I was thinking about that assault at the beginning of Macbeth of images, and and he's waiting to be sort of possessed by something bigger than him. And so often, or even in true story, I mean, that presence and that idea of the spiritual and almost the Old Testament version of grace, in fact, is something that hovers over you, a lot of your work. You're nodding.
Yeah, no, I recognize it. It's, you know, I'm not religious by practice in any sense at all, but I find the sublime and I guess particularly Catholic art very moving to me. And it's amazing how often I am, you know, through suffering comes understanding, grace is discovered through strange pathways and self-knowledge. You know, those are things that I keep returning to. I think maybe like a lot of literary kids or people who are brought up in a sort of literary environment and schooled in that way, the sort of emotional transcendence of spiritual art is kind of still overwhelming to me. And but also I think it's about being around. I said to somebody in a workshop the other day, I think like rule number one, if you want to be a director, is not about storytelling and it's not about what you want to say. It's you have to love performers. You have to really, really want to be with performers. And performers are often a very complicated and illogical and sometimes hard to work with. But you have to understand what it is to perform and the sort of dream state that great actors and singers and artists go into. And you are there to bear witness to that, to hold it, to support it, to nurture it. And I feel like I've always been a sort of actor's groupie since I was a teenager, in a way. Reader, I married one. And because of that, I've maybe at some level, some of my work, and maybe particularly this film, is in recognition of that. It's a sort of fanboy state, married with all the spiritual stuff.
Okay, yes. What an interesting combination of equals, I guess I would say. But I mean, I just think there's so often something performative about your work, but often, in effect, you take us backstage. I mean, your Lady Macbeth was kind of a performative, and we get to see her with the blood. That's almost like a backstage moment when she's reckoned or having to reckon with what she has been a part of.
Yeah.
And so you include, in some way, sort of the superstructure of theater and all those moments where characters have to sort of reckon with what they've done in their works. And it's very much a part of what you've done here in Judy, too, isn't it?
Yeah. I guess so, yeah. I mean, I think...
Had you not thought about that before?
Well, it's funny, now you say it. I remember when I was at the Royal Shakespeare Company and we'd talk about, like, what are the lessons of Shakespeare's dramaturgy for people, you know, making plays or films. And clearly, you know, you might want to have some weddings and some funerals and there's probably some kings and some low characters. But really the DNA of it is the interplay of the private and the public and the way that characters often in the public eye kind of move between their public face and their private face and how those two things develop. And you know, is that true in all drama? Maybe not, but it is maybe sort of in the DNA of the stuff that I've made, and it's certainly true in this film that, you know, nobody was. Maybe it's the central inquiry of this film is like, how are you private when you are so manifestly public all the time?
Yeah, or when can you be private, mm-hmm. and when do you fight the intrusion of the public into your private life?
Absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, it's just an interesting, delicate balance, and for me, this gets back so much to the kind of lack of self-awareness that these characters so often have in your pieces, and they mm-hmm. can't control these things.
Yeah, I mean, there's a famous quote that Garland said about, you know, don't be a second-rate version of someone else, be a first-rate version of yourself. And it's funny that speaks to, I guess, another term that I often use, which I think dovetails with some of the things you're identifying, which is about authenticity. I think in a sort of postmodern, you know, increasingly fractured, self-fracturing world, you know, the idea of the authentic, who is real, what is real, keep it real, is more and more engaging to us. And what I find compelling about these figures like Garland is, you know, she was in some ways she's seen as the most authentic movie star ever. You know, she has that quality that, you know, you find in Tom Hanks or someone, that absolute accessibility where you feel you absolutely know that person. And yet, what is the authentic Garland? There were so many different versions of her actually when you look at it, and she was aware of that. And so teasing at what is authentic, what is an authentic king, an authentic murderer, and what is human, and the relationship between those two things, I think, is something that I've often come back to.
It's the treatment. We're talking about authenticity with the director of Judy, Rupert Gould. We can't sit here and not talk about your incredible star, Renee Zellweger, and I have to ask you what your first conversation with her was like about this material, because it's first of all, playing somebody who's so incredibly exposed all the time. Mm. I mean, actors are vulnerable or asked to be vulnerable as part of the process almost always, but somebody who has to play vulnerability is a very different thing, isn't it?
Yeah. I think like any journey you make with an actor is a journey from third person to first person, and that was particularly true of this in that we would talk about her and Judy and as though Renee had nothing to do with her at all, and like how would she climb up the mountain and sort of become, you know, wear the clothes of Judy. And I think probably the early meetings we had were very much about, you know, the objective Judy. My job as the director was to try and move it to an I, because I was very interested in, I don't think you can act unless you're an I, but also I was interested in Renee's own I, like, and I didn't want to lose Renee totally. I didn't want, like, Gary Oldman did so brilliantly in Darkest Hour, where you can almost not see the actor at all behind the transformation into Churchill. I wanted, you know, I didn't want lots of prosthetics. I wanted it to be clearly visually Judy, but also keep Renee Zellweger at the heart of it, because I think, you know, Renee herself has had, you know, these are two actresses absolutely in the crucible of Hollywood and what that system meant. Admittedly, at quite different times, but I would argue that actually the mid-90s when Renee was coming through had its own gender sort of restrictions and prescriptions about how women were treated and how actresses were perceived, and, you know, had its own pressures. And, you know, sufficient that Renee took, you know, a few years off and out and then came back and, you know, as any actress over 40 probably gets, you know, sort of, where is she now? Who is she now? And I was sort of interested in her own experience mapping onto Judy's. So I remember, certainly by the time we were filming, I would, you know, I'd constantly say, stop worrying about the technique. I don't want to worry about the voice. I don't want to worry about the mannerisms anymore. I don't want to worry about the singing. I just want you to connect with the story in the moment and how you emotionally relate to that. And by that point, we had a really, you know, great working relationship. And, you know, she was very hungry to work. I think it was a role she probably wanted to do for a long time, but also she's a real worker as an actress. And I said to her at one point, you know, when she turned up early and word perfect again for a scene. And I remember saying, you know, you are playing one of the world's great divas. It's all right to act up a bit. But, you know, she was a trooper. And it's, I mean, of course, you don't really know. There's a sort of special alchemy when you call action on the first shot. You go like, what are we really going to get here? And literally just in the movement of her shoulders, I was like, oh, we're in a great place.
It's funny you say that, because I was really struck by how she actually has Judy's posture on stage.
It's, I mean, a brilliant physical performance.
The way she stands, it's almost as she's been sketched there.
Those,
and it's the wardrobe seemed to be transformative for her. I mean, her physical, and we can see when we're talking the difference between public and private. Judy's, especially when she's in command of the moment, her physical posture on stage was so different. You can see the sense of ownership there and the almost instinctive move to the center of the stage.
Yeah. But she was so tiny, Garland, at that point. I mean, sorry, it's Renee, but, you know, she was bird-like and she had a problem with her back, which led to that slightly sort of firm, hunched posture. And Renee caught all that absolutely beautifully, as well as the extraordinary way her hands are constantly in movement when she's talking. Yeah, it was a very, very detailed physical performance and very anchored in, yeah, particularly in that sort of back of the spine, the top part of her spine between her shoulders. You know, I always felt that was the center, you know, in a sort of a Meyerhold sense, like what is the center, where is the character placed? And once she dropped into that for each shot, you know, and like you say, it did open up on stage and become something much more sort of Phoenix-like. But yeah, she's a great physical actor.
But I guess I want to get back a little bit to the idea of having to play vulnerability, which strikes me as being particularly difficult, especially if you're playing somebody who's performing and that person's falling apart. But as a performer, as an actor, you've got to be in control of something that's in free fall.
Yeah. I
mean, there's so many contradictions that are called for in this kind of performance. It must have been a difficult needle to thread. In terms of conversation,
yeah,
with her about
it. It is. But then, you know, at heart, every acting beat is the combination of the want and the obstacle. So as long as you're really clear on what the character is pursuing in the moment and what the impediment to that is and can articulate that clearly, then, of course, the actor is bringing their own self to it. And if they've done the work on the characterization and through the rehearsal period and through the pre-shoot, then that sort of physical vulnerability will... Renee could play exceptional want, huge desire, great sense of purpose against pressing obstacle, whether it was the alcohol or the audience. And yet, however hard she played it, I'd always feel fragility. And maybe it's the two things hammering together.
It's interesting because you're talking about Renee's own appetite, and if you combine that with Judy's constant ambition, which is the one thing this towering need to communicate in any given setting, it must have dovetailed pretty neatly that they have these two kind of wants that you could combine into like a central sort of persona.
Yes, yeah, I suppose it did. I mean, it was also remembering, you know, the super want, which is to get back to her children and keeping that sort of very pure animalistic sort of need in there, and the conflicting super objectives of I want to return to my children, I need my children, almost like that Darwinistic sense, and yet also I cannot give up performing. You know, I am at home. My real home is maybe on a stage, and how those two super objectives are in conflict. You know, that's what we talk about a lot in terms of where the fulcrum of the character was. But I think a lot of it is just in sort of technical acting terms, is about being super clear about what the obstacle is rather than the intention. I think we talk a lot about intentions and you know, there's always work to be done with the actor on that. But really the enemy of the intention is the thing that you're working against. And we just will try to be as clear as possible about that.
I think that clarity you're talking about is really evident in the scenes that Renee has with the kids, because not only do we get to see what we're talking about here is that need to communicate and how when there's clarity and simplicity, it can be done, but you can also really see, and it becomes this tragic metaphor, the childhood she never had a chance to have.
Yeah, I mean, my mother-in-law, who's a health visitor, said something to me about, I don't know whether you talk about it over here, we talk about clingy children, and she'd said that, she said, you know, most of her experience in troubled homes, that when the clingy child was normally propping the mother up. And I felt that was interesting about Garland and her children, that she was, and you see that in some of the videos, she's constantly fussing over them and touching, but you can feel that even when they're in their performances together, that they are as much trying to prop her up as her support them.
Yeah, that's really evident in that, and just, you can almost feel her touching them in the phone conversations. And I'm sorry, Rupert, we are out of time. You have to come back here whenever you got another project going.
I'd love to.
No, but I guess I'll have to do this next time because we're out of time. But please come back and do the show again, would you?
I'd be thrilled to.
Okay, yeah. Our recording engineer here at NPR West is Marcia Caldwell. The show is mixed by Kat Yore. We're talking to Rupert Gould, the man who just defined how simple acting is for the new film that he directed, Judy. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment. We'll be right back. catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.